Stunned silence.
What is
this? A bit of an aside, right?
So you must be doing something, right?
And it brings us back to the same.
Tell us what you mean.
Like, I just can't think of it.
I love the enthusiasm.
Cool.
You're tuned to the 15th Station, New Zealand's first Catholic podcast. This is episode 123 for January 2018. Happy New Year! And it's always good to talk to you, Gavin, no matter what year it is. How are you, mate?
Good, James. Happy New Year to you.
Happy
New Year. It's our 12th calendar year of podcasting.
Goodness me.
I guess if we're trying to overstate things a little bit, since we've just been going just a little bit more than 10, but, you know, 12 calendar years. That's pretty good.
Also very good is Anna. How are you, Anna?
I am well, thank you.
Good to talk to you. Happy New Year.
To you too.
Happy New Church Year as well. Although I can't believe we're almost in Lent. That's a bit crazy.
We had a Happy New Church Year last month.
Well, that's true. We did. That's true. Mm. Yep, that's a good point. And of course, it's always good to talk to you. Don, how are you, Don?
Good, bro.
Good to talk, mate.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year indeed. So how's everyone doing? How's 2018 finding everyone? Is everyone in a good place? Is it all going well over there in Australia there, Gavin?
Yeah, good, thanks. I'm in my new apartment. So settling back into life in Canberra. So far so good. So
brilliant.
And only a few like monster crazy hot days so far. So,
well, you'll be glad you weren't in Sydney. Wasn't it like 47 degrees or something, or 47.3 or something crazy?
Yeah, out in the outskirts of Western Sydney, where it gets hottest. But yeah, it was in the 40s in most of Sydney, so I was glad not to be there. It was about upper 30s in Canberra, so still pretty warm.
We've had some nice weather here in New Zealand, though. It's good being in summer, you know, for those of us who've had a bit of a holiday, a bit of a break. Getting back into it, and I mean, I guess in our first story, there's the Pope talking to some, I don't know if diplomats take holidays or not really, but this is from the Catholic News Agency. In a speech to diplomats, Pope Francis said that the stability of the family is integral for the future, and that such stability is created when founded upon the faithful and lasting relationship of a man and woman. Quote, today, fleeting relationships are preferred to the stability of a definitive life project, but a house built on the sand of frail and fickle relationships cannot stand, the Pope said on January the 8th. What is needed instead is a rock on which to build solid foundations, and this rock is precisely that faithful and indissoluble communion of love that joins man and woman, a communion that has an austere and simple beauty, a sacred and inviolable character, and a natural role in the social order. Therefore, it is urgent, he continued, that government policies support the family, on which, quote, the future and the development of states depend, end quote, and without future challenges cannot be met. Without which future challenges cannot be met. Pope Francis's words were addressed to ambassadors and other members of the Vatican diplomatic corps in a message for the start of the new year. Currently, the Holy See has diplomatic relations with 183 states, as well as the European Union and the Sovereign Military Order of Malta, after having established diplomatic ties with Burma, also known as the Republic of the Union of Myanmar, in May 2017. Of these, 89 states maintain embassies to the Holy See in Rome, including the Embassy of South Africa, which was established last year. In his lengthy speech, which centered on human rights, Pope Francis not only emphasized the importance of the family, but also the right to life, beginning in the womb. 70 years after the creation of the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights, it's painful to see the many ways the fundamental rights of human beings continue to be violated, he said. The first among these is the right of every human person to life, liberty, and personal security, he noted, which are not only frequently destroyed by war and violence, but by other means such as abortion. I think primarily of innocent children discarded even before they are born, unwanted at times simply because they are ill or malformed or as a result of the selfishness of adults, the Pope stated. Pretty hard-hitting stuff. The Pope straight out of the gate in 2018, talking with the diplomatic corps there. Gavin, what did you make of his remarks?
Well, he didn't pull too many punches. He would have had a few diplomats there from countries, including from Australia. I assume the diplomat from the ambassador from Australia was probably there, and a range of others from, I think we're up to about 25 or 26 countries now that have same-sex marriage across the world, and some of them would have heard what the Pope has to say about that issue, and many more countries probably where abortion is, if not legal, at least allowed in a range of different ways, as it is in New Zealand, where it remains illegal, but exceptions are allowed that mean it's essentially on demand. So a couple of the big hot-button issues that continue to pervade public discourse, and the Pope was pretty clear what he thought about each of those, and will be sending that message to the diplomats, to the countries they represent.
Yes, it was, I mean, I guess you sort of look at his messages of previous years, Anna, and I mean, the diplomatic corps, when they get together, and it's often one of the first sort of signals the Pope sends. But, you know, I mean, it does sort of read as in other news, the Pope is Catholic kind of announcement, the sort of things that he's focusing on, which is always good. I mean, I guess from this is a Catholic podcast, so I'm not surprised if we're all sitting here going, yeah, this is good stuff. But did you like what the Pope was saying?
Absolutely. I think, you know, he's right about the importance of family as the foundation to a good social order, and and to, you know, it's about time that, it's not that he's never proclaimed this message before, but the church needs to continue to proclaim that message. And it's great that it's, you know, he's doing it in a particular way. And, you know, perhaps he kind of gets away with this, straight talking that he style that he has, because he has a bit of a smile on him, and you know, he comes across as being reasonably lighthearted, I suppose, even when he is talking about perhaps difficult things. So I think it's great that, you know, perhaps he uses his good regard that he has in the wider community to continue to promote these things. And if there are people in that group who have heard his message and it's, you know, resonated with them, and they can actually perhaps do something about it, then that's great. It's really good.
It is really good, and I think it's something where it's good to hear him taking a strong stance and, like you say, not pulling any punches. Don, I can imagine you were pleased to see the remarks from the Pope.
Absolutely, but it is incredibly confusing, because what he's saying is incredibly orthodox and Catholic, which is great. But then you take a look at some of the things he's done in the past in terms of the footnote on Amoris Laetitia, and that's in contradiction to what he's saying now, because either marriage is complex and there's issues around it, and there are cases where that indissolubility is maybe not so indissoluble, or it's very simple and you have a rock and it's indissoluble. So there's that confusion. And also last month he gave the equestrian pontifical order to a Dutch former minister of government who is incredibly pro-abortion. So, you know, I just don't, you know, the integrity of his pro-life stance is in odds to giving someone who is a abortion and LGBT activist the equestrian pontifical order. So it's just very confusing, and I guess this is a legacy of this pontificate to some degree, that he is confusing and at times at odds with himself.
Gavin, did you find yourself confused? Do you think Don's got a point there about the Pope being, you know, saying one thing and doing another?
Well, I think it's Don is correct to make the point that there is something curious about someone being honoured in that way. In many countries, there are awards of this kind. And like in New Zealand and Australia, we have the sort of the Queen's Birthday honours and the New Year's Day honours and those sorts of things. You'd hope that the Vatican, if we want to call that a country, and therefore the awards that come from that would be ones that would be congruent with the teachings of the church. And it's true to say that, you know, that we can read stories about a person's stance on a number of issues, and maybe in many other ways there are people who made a great contribution to their country, and there's the question of, does the view on abortion disqualify the person from being awarded in that way? And I think there's an argument to be made that given the gravity of abortion, that support for it could indeed be a disqualifying factor from receiving such an award. But I don't know much. I just actually read this story today as well. So I don't know the full story about this particular former minister and politician, what other good works that she may have achieved. And then the question of, you know, can they override or supersede the obvious concerns around her efforts to support, and I think even, you know, the broadening of abortion availability for people around the world. So I look at what the Pope said. His words are clear. We obviously want people's actions to adhere with their words wherever possible. I think it would be my way to try and navigate your difficult question.
Well navigated. I think what the Pope was saying was bang on. I think we all, you know, especially the position around the first amongst all rights of every human person is to life, liberty, and personal security. And I like the fact that he talked about that being taken away by, you know, war on one side, which is something that you know, he has historically been very strong on, and then obviously about with abortion as well. So taking quite a pro-life stance is great to sort of see from the Pope. I mean, what do you think? Don's got a legitimate criticism there that sometimes it's a bit confusing what the Pope says, or were you just generally buoyed by what he was saying and going, yes, this is the Pope that I like?
Well, I think I pretty much just read it at face value. Like, he's saying things that are great, and yes, perhaps I don't always understand some of his motives or some of the things that he supports or comes out with on occasion. But I think, you know, I think fundamentally he is a good Catholic. You know, like we can be assured of that. And yes, there are perhaps, although he's never necessarily come out and said it as Pope, you know, perhaps some of the synod, the marriage and family synod stuff was perhaps a bit confusing. But it's actually good for us to continue to dissect that more. Like, it's probably, you know, there's more scope for understanding him and learning what he's really getting at. So, you know, we were pretty lucky with Benedict, who was very straightforward in how he presented himself, but John Paul II wasn't always easy to understand. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes what he allowed to happen in some cases kind of, yeah, was confusing as well. So, I think that's part of having a Pope, and that they're a particular person with, you know, particular personality and etc.
Yeah, I mean, and it's tricky, right? I mean, Don, I mean, you're having to sort of cover a lot, you know, wide spectrum. You know, having to speak to, like, you know, a billion Catholics.
It's not tricky. You've got three jobs as bishop: three jobs, governance, the sacraments, and teaching. And basically, you've got to teach Catholic people and the people under you what Catholic teaching is. And more, the footnote on Amoris Laetitia is confusing. What he said now is not confusing. It's great. Just come out with more of the stuff, less on the footnotes, less on, you know, giving
some bumper sticker
Gregory the Great medals or, you know, honors to people who are basically living lives and publicly against the teaching of the church. It's that simple. It's real simple.
Okay.
I think we can sell some t-shirts.
Yeah.
Yo, Frank, less with the footnotes.
More with the speaking, less with the footnotes. I mean, I do think that some of these things, the reason why I get where you're coming from, Don, usually, and this time is one of those usuallys, I get where you're coming from. I think the consideration you've got to take is that you're absolutely right, the teaching and governance, yeah, and the sacraments, obviously, and when you look at the teaching and the governance, something like this has, I think, far more teaching weight than something like a footnote in a Morris Laetitia. And the reason why I say that is because this is the kind of thing that for the vast majority of Catholics that is going to actually resonate and hit them, because they're going to hear about it, it's going to be reported on, it's going to be covered in, you know, the news, whereas a lot of the other stuff does strike as inside baseball. So I do think it's good that when he has an opportunity to speak in a way that's going to be recorded and carried, you know, across mainstream media, he's speaking in a very Catholic position.
Right, but he should do that consistently.
Yep, absolutely.
And that would be my criticism. He doesn't do that consistently.
Right.
And he's at odds with himself quite a lot.
Okay, well, he probably isn't at odds with this next story. This is from Radio New Zealand. Faith-based institutions need to be included when the government investigates the abuse of children in state care, says a psychologist involved with Australia's inquiry into abuse. The Labor-led government has promised to set up an inquiry, and groups of survivors want its scope broadened. They are being backed by psychologist Michelle Melville, who was a consultant to Australia's Royal Commission on Institutional Sex Abuse. Dr. Melville spent 9 years consulting around child sex abuse cases at the St. John of God Brothers, which included a New Zealand case in Canterbury, where there were 76 victims at the hands of two priests. She said that the Australian Commission found the majority of children sexually assaulted were abused in faith-based institutions, so they should be included in New Zealand's inquiry. She said if it did not happen, only half the story would be told. Quote, these victims of faith-based organisations need to be seen in a context, and the context is far is wider than the discussion about whether they are the same or different to those people in the state-based institutions. It's critically important to their well-being. Dr. Melville said the men she had met were in dire straits. They're not people who are searching about for money. They are people who want to be recognised and acknowledged properly. Interesting call here, Anna. And, you know, it's always hard whenever we cover these stories, but they are really important stories of the day for Catholics around the world. What do you make of the doctor's call here that the inquiry should expand to include faith-based organisations, not just state?
Well, I don't have a problem with that in principle. I'm wondering what the government, like what their purpose was as far as looking at state-owned care facilities and things like that, whether they are looking at their own facilities and how they can make... like for the government to make the things that they run better. If they're looking at, which is what I guess the Australian Royal Commission was about looking at sexual abuse sort of across the board and looking at what are the different organisations, what kind of actions have they done to produce perhaps this situation, and then what are our recommendations to fix this? So if that's what the inquiry was about, then by all means incorporate all different organisations into it. But I'm not sure what the government was intending with their inquiry. And if their inquiry isn't really looking at sort of what are the systemic problems and all that kind of stuff, then I think it won't really help the survivors or probably give them what they would like. But I think, you know, we should do our own version, I suppose, of the Royal Commission that happened in Australia. And, yeah, especially because we know that certainly from the Catholic Church point of view, the various religious orders who had problems in Australia were also here in New Zealand. So, you know, it's probably going to... You know, when we already know that there were cases here in New Zealand. So,
yeah. It's tricky. It's a good point you raised, though, Anna, about what's the actual purpose of the inquiry. And if the purpose is to investigate, you know, what the state's been doing and what the state needs to do to fix what the state has been doing, then that's one thing. If it's to look more broadly at where are these cases, more like a Royal Commission. I kind of agree with you in principle. Don, what's your sort of thoughts on this, mate?
I kind of think unless there's proof to kind of lead you towards these faith-based organisations, why are we opening up inquiry and spending government money on something where there is no evidence of anything untoward happening at this stage? Basically, the inquiry into state institutions, the catalyst was that there was proof that individuals were abused under the care of the state, hence the inquiry. Where's the smoking gun for the latter?
That's a good point. I mean, that's to Anna's exact point, right? What's the actual goal of the inquiry in the first place? And if the event that started it was the abuse of people in state care, it's a good point.
Hey, sorry, Don, are you saying that we haven't had any cases of abuse?
I'm not saying that we haven't had any cases. I'm saying that there isn't any, reason for us to reopen or relitigate a lot of these cases. And is there, well, to your point, well, what are we looking to achieve here? And is there evidence that we will uncover more if we proceed along the lines of an additional investigation?
So you're saying,
but
yes.
I'm not sure if it's about... James.
That's right.
I'm not sure if it's about uncovering more. I think what is the purpose of this inquiry? And is it about actually uncovering the reasons why abuse was allowed to happen? And therefore, how are we going to stop it? And, you know, what are the things that need to be in place in order to prevent it from
as well as getting justice for the people who were abused
in terms of a payout
or whatever,
or jail time, or acknowledgement
for the perpetrators.
I think so. I mean, just looking at the article, and we'll put it in the show notes, and there's a link through as well to the Prime Minister talking about the August recommendation from the United Nations about an independent inquiry, specifically talking about children who are placed in state care between the 1950s and the 1980s. And I guess the point that they're trying to look for here is the desire to sort of expand it is, I guess, coming from the perspective to find out where these cases were happening throughout New Zealand in that era, regardless of the institution that caused it. Gavin, what's your sort of thoughts on this? And obviously, you've been sort of close to what's been going on in Australia as well with the Royal Commission. What's your thoughts about expanding the scope here? I mean, I guess we're on there's two angles to it. Do we expand the scope to cover everything, or are we just focused on the state-based issues?
Well, I think there have been some good points raised about what is it that we're trying to actually look at, and. Are we trying to look at a series of historical cases from that period that you've just mentioned there, the 50s to the 80s, and really critique what happened then? Or are we trying to, as the Royal Commission over here in Australia has tried to do, to the best of our knowledge, given that there's often a lag in terms of reporting of abuse, but the spike in abuse, as we understand it, was sort of in that period between sort of the 50s and the 80s in Australia. Probably reason to suggest it was similar in New Zealand, and there's a reason why those dates have been chosen for the inquiry into state-based institutions or state care. Or are we trying to say, okay, what happened then, what's happened since, and what's happening today to... try and make sure that those things never happen again, or certainly that institutions aren't doing anything that can make perpetrators free to continue to abuse children. So, it is an interesting point. when I heard about the establishment of this inquiry, I thought it was curious that they would focus on state-based care. You know, obviously, I take no joy in the church's failings in the theory of being publicised, but I think that our terrible history has to be examined. And one of the things that I think the Australian Royal Commission allowed is for the broader context to be examined rather than the individual circumstances of a particular child or teenager who was abused. It's very important that those cases are heard and the criminal process followed. But to look at the context more broadly and say, well, hang on, what was happening in society, what was happening within government organisations or faith-based institutions that allow things to happen, and how do we make sure those things don't come back again? Now, we could debate what the Royal Commission recommended over here and whether we think those are worthy or not. But to me, when it was announced that there was going to be this investigation, it seemed curious to me that the Catholic Church and or faith-based institutions more broadly would be would not be included. So to my mind, a process should be as exhaustive as possible, with a broader view of how can we try and make sure that the safety of children continues to be paramount and the work of all organisations that deal with children and young people.
So I guess that's pretty much where I fall on this. Whenever we talk about this issue, I'm actually quite pleased to see a focus beyond the church. I'll put it that way.
Yeah.
So I think your point around the broader context is something that I would really, really like to see investigated. And I would have thought this would have gone the other way around. In other words, a church-based inquiry, which then is broadened to say, well, if we're looking at the abuse of minors, let's look at the abuse of minors full stop. Let's not look at it based on, oh, well, just those that were in state or just... You can, you know, carve the statistics up later, yeah, just for interest, and also to try and find root cause connections or, you know, cause and effect or whatever. But I would say if what we're looking for is for the abuse of... the causes of the abuse of minors in the 50s and the 80s in New Zealand, look at it in that context and go right across all organisations, anyone who had the care of the young, because it's such an abhorrent, inexcusable crime that we need to expunge it from the way in which we operated. I do think, though, to your point, Gavin, and I think it's a really good one, mate, I do think that the challenge of being able to have an unbiased assessment of the broader societal context would uncover a few things which... And this is just me, this is just supposition, but I think it would uncover a few things which would maybe make secular society squirm a little bit, that actually this isn't necessarily something that is related to religion at all, or to the priesthood or to celibacy or anything like that, and is actually a bit more of an issue, a sickness, a criminal sickness associated with... you know, members of society, and that can be quite confronting. So we've had a long period of time, rightly so, quite frankly, of the church taking the appropriate hits for what went on with, as we've talked about before, not just the actual abusers, but the moving of those abusers around, which is just inexcusable when done in clear thought premeditation. But I think that broadening that, that's the way I thought it would have gone. So the fact that it started from the state and then they're now saying we should, you know, include the church, in principle, I have no problem with that either.
Yeah, I think that the danger becomes when you have secular people, you know, taking their ideological stance. And correct me if I'm wrong, Gavin, but, you know, they've taken some of the recommendations of the Royal Commission in Australia, and some of them are basically saying things like, celibacy in the clergy has somehow got a relationship with the level of abuse, which is ridiculous to imply that celibacy somehow makes people abusers is just ridiculous, especially given most abusers are actually people who are having sex as well.
Yeah, given, I mean, just to add to that question, the Royal Commission in Australia has focused on only on faith-based, or is it focused on all abuse of minors?
Well, it focused on all, but in theory, it focused on all. I think it's, I've certainly seen people mention the fact that Islam seemed exempt from any scrutiny.
Hmm.
And it's my understanding that there were some, I don't think it's true to say that government schools weren't looked at, or public schools or state schools, depending on your terminology, but that schools that are run by governments, there were some cases that revolved around government schools, but there have been a number of stories that have come out about sort of independent of the Royal Commission, but during that period of the commission, talking about, I think there was a group of 10 or 12 students in Victoria who have sued the state government because they experienced abuse at the hands of a teacher in a government school who was moved to another school after it was known that he had been abusing children in much the same way that priests and brothers were allowed to. But that didn't seem to fall under the Royal Commission's investigation. So in theory, it was all institutions and how they responded to child sexual abuse was what the Australian Royal Commission was meant to look at. But I think there were some holes as part of the investigation, either intentionally or, I mean, it cost, I think, several hundred million millions of dollars and took 5 years to, you know, and maybe it could have taken 15 years and cost $1.5 billion if it had run its course. But I think the sense was how institutions of all kinds, government, church, Boy Scouts, all those sorts of groups responded to child sexual abuse within their institutions.
Right.
Was the remit. So.
Well, I mean, we could talk about it all show, but it's something where I think we're going to be, you know, 12 years we've been talking about the abuse challenges and scandal and crime, and as I said before, there's just the inexcusability of it, so I don't need to even say it again, and I think we'll still be talking about it in 12 years, unfortunately. But if that's what it takes for it never to happen again, then let's talk about it forever, as far as I'm concerned. Moving on. This is from the AFP. Pope Francis called for hospitality towards migrants, calling it a sin to give in to the fear of the other, as he marked the World Day of Migrants and Refugees. It is not easy to put oneself in the shoes of people who are so different from us, the pontiff said during a solemn mass at St. Peter's Basilica. Local communities are sometimes afraid that the newly arrived will disturb the established order, will steal something that they have long laboured to build up, Francis said. While such fears are not a sin, said the spiritual leader of the world's 1.3 billion Roman Catholics, the sin is to refuse to encounter the other, the different, the neighbour. The sin is to allow these fears to determine our responses, to limit our choices, to compromise respect and generosity, to feed hostility and rejection, Francis said, adding, we often refuse to encounter the other and raise barriers to defend ourselves. Ooh, Don? Your turn to lead off. What do you think about what the Pope said on this time?
I think it's interesting. And certainly he's right at an individual level. You know, we should judge every person on the strength of their character. But certainly on at a policy level, I've got to agree with the likes of Trump, who basically says that, you know, and it's true when you think about it, there are some countries who are more compatible with immigrants than other countries. And he's taken the unfortunate extreme case of Haiti and basically said, probably from Haiti, we're going to have issues in terms of you import the same number of immigrants from this country versus the same number of immigrants from this country would have potentially different issues. Given the issues that they're experiencing with the flood of refugees that they've got in Sweden at the moment and the problems they have integrating them, had those same number of refugees come from Australia and New Zealand, I'd wager a very large bet that they wouldn't have those same level of problems.
So... Okay, Gavin, here's my challenge with what Don's saying, if you were to take a large portion of refugees from a country like Australia or New Zealand, which are quite multicultural, cosmopolitan countries, you are going to be wrapping up in that a whole raft of different subcultures, if you like. Whereas if you're taking refugees from a more of a monocultural country, then you probably you can't. It's a little bit easier to sort of box and dismiss and say, right, well, everyone's going to believe the same thing, so therefore they're all going to pose the same problems. But in the case of the refugee problems that we've sort of faced over the last few years, you're talking about people that are fleeing from multiple countries, that are multiple different versions of those nationalities. So is it possible to basically say that you're going to have problems coming from some countries when the countries themselves don't have the people aren't all the same coming from that country?
It's probably fair to say that maybe, but I think there's a generosity and a hospitality that the Pope is reminding us, and particularly he himself with his background and coming on the back of the Christmas season and the discussion about sort of people who are fleeing various things, as Mary and Joseph were trying to.
I think we got the reference.
Would you like me to explain the Gospels?
Yeah, that's right.
There's this guy named Jesus. I think the Pope is responding to, I think, an important reality at the moment that exists in some circles, that sort of this ultra-nationalism and a sense of, well, this is my country and I don't want people coming into my country who might change the way that I believe my country should operate or how society should interact with one another in my country. So I think that that's a phenomenon that exists in some countries at the moment, that the Pope and others feel is unhelpful, and probably more than unhelpful, we'll probably say is unchristian and inhumane. When we think about some of the lives that some of these people are seeking to escape, and to, you know, there are legitimate questions that have to be asked about people's background and the status of their seeking asylum or their refugee status. I'm not saying throw open the borders, but I think there is a lot of unfortunate language and fear, and that idea of what the Pope refers to, fear of others, that some people are demonstrating, that I think the Pope is right to call out. But it's one of many very difficult policy challenges, a wicked policy problem.
A wicked policy problem.
Often described.
It's well described. It is a wicked problem. So, Anna, you can solve it for us in a podcast episode, I'm sure. What do you think about what the Pope's saying here?
Look, I think that that way of, you know, like learning to place yourself in someone else's shoes, to have an outlook of encountering the other, so, you know, whoever that might be, and wanting to encounter them regardless of, you know, what you perceive about them, is like, you know, not just for refugees, but it's a way of life that is important for many people. And we see it in that we have a problem with that even in the scope of perhaps religious or social differences. You know, we're not very good at interacting with someone who thinks differently from us because we've forgotten that concept of, well, I'm just trying to discover and build relationship with you. And it doesn't matter to, well, you know, it's irrelevant to your political position or where you're from or anything like that. So it's a good thing to remind all of us that that's a good way of living, because what it does is that it is something that reduces fear, and it's a fruitful thing for people. And yes, there is difficulties in the sense of immigration and refugees, and I understand the difficulties that different countries are faced with. And there's always going to be that tension there. I don't think that there is ever not going to be that tension. But, you know, to open your heart to someone is never a wrong thing, right? Even if it doesn't end well or whatever, it's always the act of love. So that's what we should be aiming for. So,
And if we take reference to that great book called The Catechism, there is a responsibility on the person seeking refuge as well to, you know, try to be grateful and to engage with the culture of the host nation of which he's going to.
Yeah, are you suggesting, Don, that some aren't grateful for being, in effect, rescued?
Yes, there are some cases. I think if we go back to Sweden in general, that is probably the basket case of... and you look at some of the suburbs and that basically become crime centres where police are even scared to go. And previously very progressive, very liberal Sweden, the Prime Minister has come out and basically said, you know, at no stage will we have that level of immigration and make that same mistake again.
Okay. I mean, I guess the thing for me that I always find about this very, very complicated issue is, what's the alternative? I mean, basically what we're looking for here is, ideally, yeah, we'd actually have a bit of peace. How about we don't have people being refugees from their own countries and being cast out by civil wars? But while we continue to, you know, find unbelievably new ways of killing each other, we are going to have these issues where people are displaced, and you can't just sort of let them, you know, die. There's no justice in that either. So I guess there's a balance to be struck, right?
I agree, and thank you, Hillary and Obama, for creating the Syrian flag.
But I mean, even if you look at the other, like, that's not their first civil war ever, right? It's not the first time you've had refugees coming out, and not all refugees can be traipsed back to American foreign policy.
It is the worst case since the World War, but anyway.
Okay, but if we take the World War as an example, actually, that's a good example, because even there what you had is you had refugees dispersed right across the world, all from different countries in Europe across the world. And I take your point around the refugees themselves being grateful and finding a way to integrate into the culture that they are moving to. That's fair. It's a relationship on both sides. It's not a matter of, you know, you get to pick and choose. But I think there isn't a do-nothing option here. There isn't a just leave them. And I think that's the struggle, is trying to find what is the compromise, what is the best way to, what is the least worst option, is probably the better way to phrase it, because being realistic about what it actually is, it's not ideal. None of the refugees want to leave, and countries would rather have everything nice and simple themselves. I mean, it segues nicely into our next story from Radio New Zealand. Four church and community groups have been selected to sponsor refugees and help them settle in New Zealand. Up to 30 Syrian refugees will be approved for residence by June under the pilot scheme. The chosen community organisations will be announced later this month. Sponsors will be responsible for arranging accommodation, connecting them with local services, and placing them in employment. Catholic Church agency Caritas is among the groups hoping to take part. Its director, Julianne Hickey, said it already has experience helping refugees set up new homes. Everything from spoons to duvets to stocking up fridges to make sure that when a family comes in, they're welcomed, as well as making sure we are sensitive to the trauma that a refugee family has gone through, she said. So that psychological and social is really important aspect of helping a family settle. So that psychological and social. New Zealand Red Cross National Migration Program Manager Rachel O'Connor said the pilot was exciting. She said it was similar to a program in Canada which has offered protection and a new home to more than 275,000 refugees since 1979. It's another opportunity, it's another door for people to come through, she said. I mean, I guess, Gavin, I look at that with some hope, I mean, we've had some limited experience. Even I remember in my childhood having from the Iraq War. Thank you, President Bush. Having a lot of refugees. We had probably more thank you Saddam Hussein, but you had we had Iraqi refugees coming into New Zealand in the mid 90s, and the churches would got involved to sort of help settle those families in, and I saw with my own eyes here you'd have families coming here who were doctors and architects in Iraq, and they're coming to New Zealand and they don't know the language very well at all. Their qualifications don't count. They're having to start from scratch. It was incredibly painful for them. But being able to have a community organisation like a church involved with actually welcoming them into the society, I think, made for a much better transition. So one would hope that this pilot could be done in a similar vein, perhaps?
Yeah, I mean, you think of people who came from Bosnia and Kosovo. Thanks, President Clinton. Working our way through. I think what the story demonstrates is the place of the church in leading the way in this sort of outreach and really heeding the call of Pope Francis to do that. I mean, yeah, you've spoken about the group of Iraqi families that came to New Zealand. I mean, here in Australia, they've just announced a young person to represent Australia at a big gathering of young people in a couple of months. And she happens to be from the Chaldean, so the Iraqi Catholic community. There are these people who come from these communities who make such a contribution. People who've often gone through such hardship that we couldn't even imagine and are relatively simple and luxurious existences. So I think for the church to be speaking up and standing up to welcome some of these families in New Zealand is an important part of the church's mission.
It is complicated, Anna, no doubt. I mean, as we've talked about with both these stories, but it is something where I think finding a way to bring people, to allow people to come in and to come in a way, to Don's point, where they can show gratitude as well and it becomes a new relationship for both parties. But something like this, if a pilot scheme has done well, I mean, Canada with 275,000 refugees is quite a lot, so maybe we can be successful?
It has every reason to be successful. I think one of the things is that I guess a government of a country analyzes someone's
validity.
Validity to enter the country, but that's such a and it's stale, it's sterile. But to have people enter the country, but then connect with the people of that country, that's got to be a good thing. And that is the thing that helps them to enter into the culture of the country. I bet it must be horrible if you come into a country, you're a refugee, you're traumatized from that life, and you are not integrated into the community at all. Like, how do we expect people to somehow become New Zealanders or Australians or whatever if they're not sort of given that opportunity to connect with the wider community? So I think for anyone coming into New Zealand, that's a very, but especially refugees, it's a necessary part of them making a new life in a new country, because it's not necessarily something they've chosen. They've chosen to leave their country, but under better circumstances, they would have wanted to have stayed, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But so they've been driven out. So you have to help them. They need more help than perhaps other immigrants who choose to come for other reasons. I'm excited to see that's happening, and I really do hope that for the refugees and for those communities helping out, that it's a really fruitful operation.
Yeah, yeah. Don, I mean, is that your point in terms of them being grateful and being able to come here and integrate into the society rather than just being outside of it?
There's that, and it's great that we're putting this level of resourcing towards the refugees, and there's something that we definitely should do. But just illustrates my point before that numbers matter. And if we're looking at 300,000 since 1979 to Canada, that's really not a lot. What we saw in Sweden, in the Swedish case, is 150,000 refugees coming in 1 year, 2015. And that's where they had problems. And it goes back to illustrate that we have to have a sensible kind of immigration policy where we balance the needs of refugees with basically a type of program like we've got in New Zealand, and we've got the level of resourcing that we can support that type of integration. Because if you blow it, then what about the future refugees that would have gone into Sweden? You could argue that the 150,000 have blown it for a lot of the future refugees. So if we're going to do this on a sustainable basis, and if the world and people are going to be crappy to each other on a sustainable basis, and we're going to continue to have refugees, then we have to be careful not to blow it for the future refugees.
Yep, no, that's a fair point. That's a good point. How do we do this in a sustainable fashion so that it isn't something which is putting undue pressure and breaking the system and basically taking generosity from countries and then destroying it for the future? Because it seems just like, you know, Christ, when he said, you know, the poor will always be with us, it feels like that, you know, that those disaffected by war, unfortunately, it looks like will always be with us until we can have peace reigning across the world. Sooner the better, I think. There's just no way to segue from that to this story, Gavin. I don't know.
Well, there was, but you missed it.
Did I? Okay, another door for people to come through. I'm not quite seeing it, but I'll go into it. This is from the Townsville Bulletin. Police and paramedics were called to the Sacred Heart Cathedral in Townsville a number of times this week after reports of a dead body lying on a bench in the forecourt. Emergency services attended the area of on multiple occasions to find the newly installed Jesus the Homeless sculpture lying in his new permanent home on the edge of the cathedral gardens. While homeless Jesus is a visual representation of those in need, no human members of the community required medical attention in that location. Catholic Diocese of Townsville Communications and Vocations Coordinator, that's a long title, Neil Helmore,
yes,
said a woman who parks in the cathedral car park contacted police on Wednesday morning to report a dead body on a bench. A QPS car screamed up Stanley Street, sirens blaring, and pulled into the car park, he said. They went to the lady and the bench and just to discover homeless Jesus was the dead body. A Queensland ambulance spokesperson said paramedics also attended the scene just before 6 p.m. on Tuesday night, but left after being unable to locate any human bodies in the area. Mr. Helmore said this is not the first time the sculpture has made people jump, with homeless Jesus residing in the back of the cathedral before it was permanently placed in the garden. Well, it's sort of a, you know, light but dark story, Gavin, to end, I guess. But I mean, not appreciating modern art here with installations of Jesus the homeless.
Yeah, well, I understand that the idea was to have the, I mean, obviously in any city or Townsville, in any place, a cathedral is obviously a prominent place. I think there was a hope from the diocese, and I think the Catholic Education Office was part of this as well, but a non-religious prominent place might be where the sculpture might end up, so that it might be seen by larger numbers of people and to try and evoke a sense of generosity and support for people who are themselves homeless. Would be, you know, that people would have that sense of obligation and support for them. But I'm sure in the cathedral grounds it will still have that, the ability to do that, but hopefully not too many people thinking that there's someone dead there.
No, here's hoping not. Oh, there's a lot of rustling going on. Must be you, Gavin. I think he's moving around. Moving around.
It's always me. You get blamed. I get blamed for a lot of stuff on this podcast.
Well, you can go back through 122 episodes if you want to, everyone, to see how many times I've blamed Gavin for things that he wasn't responsible for.
122, probably.
Yeah, probably. But just go yeah. Count them up. www.station15.co.nz. If you haven't already subscribed to the podcast, you can subscribe for free. We don't charge. We don't charge for 12 years of this kind of amazing discussion. You can subscribe. You can find us on iTunes under The 15th Station, also on Google Play. If you want to reach out and have a chat, we always love to hear from you. You can send us an email to feedback@station15.co.nz. Or you can, it's station15.co.nz, they both work. Or you can find us on twitter.com/station15 or facebook.com/station15. Always a pleasure to talk to you, Anna. Thank you for making the time.
Oh, you're welcome.
And Don, always a pleasure to hear your dulcet tones from wherever you are in the world, even though this time it was just in Auckland, right?
Auckland.
Good to talk to you, mate.
Likewise.
And Gavin, as I say every time, there wouldn't be the 15th station without you. So thank you very much, mate, for making the time from Australia. Always good to talk to you.
There wouldn't be as much rustling on it. No, that's for sure.
There wouldn't be as much rustling. There wouldn't be as much rustling.
Thank you, James.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, thank you.
And thank you out there for listening to us. We hope you've enjoyed the show and we look forward to talking to you next month. But until then, take care and God bless.
This production is affiliated with SQPN, the StarQuest Production Network, leading the way.